Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. Actually, let me start again. 3, 2, and 1. Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, February 12th, Joe was joined by Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, Senior Fellow at the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College, Ambassador Fred Hoff, and Albany Law School Professor Sarah Rogerson.
So I want to talk, first of all, not so much about Trump or court orders or so forth, but I would like to talk about Gaza. Obviously, this happened during the fund drive, and we did talk about it when we returned last Friday, but we were on the air. We didn't talk about that press conference that the president gave with Benjamin Netanyahu and saying that he wanted to make Gaza the Riviera of the Middle East. And the so some thought, well, and then the next day they said, oh, you know, people around Trump are walking that back. And then they were taking that. And they, yeah, he didn't mean that. What he meant was, and so then over the last couple of days, they've said to the president, oh, so you didn't mean that? And he goes, oh, no, I meant that. And so you want it to be, you only want it to be temporary? Oh, no, I want it to be permanent. Okay. So this is what a phrase that was used constantly during the first Trump administration, and it's already being employed in the second Trump administration, which is this doubling down on things. Well, King Abdullah II of Jordan on Tuesday rebuffed President Trump's proposal for his country to absorb Palestinians living in Gaza, saying that he remained opposed to a plan that Mr. Trump has laid out to clear the territory so the U.S. can seize control of it. I believe he said, quote, we're taking it, Trump did. During a, quote, constructive meeting with the U.S. president at the White House, King Abdullah said he reiterated Jordan's steadfast position against the displacement of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank. This is the unified Arab position, he stated in a post on social media after the meeting. Rebuilding Gaza without displacing the Palestinians and addressing the dire humanitarian situation should be the priority for all. His statement came hours after Mr. Trump insisted the United States had the authority to, quote unquote, take Gaza, part of an effort to pressure the leader of Jordan and other Arab nations to embrace a forced removal, which has obviously drawn widespread condemnation. We will have Gaza, said Mr. Trump as he sat down next to King Abdullah and the Crown Prince Hussein of Jordan. It's a war-torn area. We're going to take it. We're going to hold it. We're going to cherish it. King Abdullah largely demurred when asked by reporters about Mr. Trump's proposal, describing the president as a force for peace in the region and saying Jordan was prepared to assist sick Palestinian children. Nice pivot. But according to his statement, King Abdullah was more direct with Mr. Trump in private. Oh, my God. Fred Hoff, what do we make of this?
It's difficult to know what to make of it, Joe, to be honest with you. But I think what we're seeing with this Gaza Club Med proposal is something that we Americans may have to get used to over the next 4 years, and that is the president treating his foreign policy role, at least the public foreign policy role, as if it's a reality TV episode or a professional wrestling match. leaving it to others to clean up and try to explain to world leaders what he really meant to say. Now, I know the president has reiterated the central points of this proposal, that the United States is going to take the territory, that 2 million Palestinians are going to be removed and perhaps not allowed back. Nevertheless, I can assure you the Secretary of State and everybody else is trying to explain to foreign leaders, hey, here's what the president really meant to say. You know, what the president is really trying to do is to provoke Arab leaders to come up with alternatives. Now, during his first term, the president was surrounded by adults, chief of staff, national security advisor, who are often able to prevent him from speaking extemporaneously on foreign policy, national security issues. There are adults like Marco Rubio at State, Mike Waltz, his national security advisor, serving Trump now. But the president, who has supreme confidence in his own judgment, his own genius, has made it clear that he's going to say what he will say when he wants to say it. In the past, when there have been major changes to U.S. policy, the U.S. approach in the Middle East, it's involved a lot of intensive interagency study, discussion, and debate. But this idea, the one, you know, that the U.S. is going to take possession of the Gaza Strip, oust its 2 million residents, turn the area into a seaside resort, this came off the top of the president's head. The effect has been to undermine a ceasefire in Gaza that 70% of Israelis and close to 100% of Palestinians want to maintain and extend. You know, it's often been said that American foreign policy is what the president says it is. With Donald Trump in the White House, this may no longer be true. I'm quite sure there are no discussions, no planning pertaining to the U.S. takeover of the Gaza Strip, no discussions, no planning taking place anywhere in any agency or department of the U.S. government. In a practical sense, the president's commentary about the real estate potential of Gaza is unconnected to American foreign policy. And I predict this is something we're going to get used to. The president, as a non-authoritative commentator, as a guy eager to share with the world his opinions about current events, but with no earthly idea of how to implement anything. Even if we Americans get used to it, though, it's going to take a lot for people and leaders around the world to get used to this disconnect between the American president and American foreign policy.
I want to get to the other members of the panel here, but one of the things that I found interesting is I was showing the group during when Fred was talking that there was a model illustration of what is looked to be the new Gaza Strip. What's interesting about that drawing is it was actually drawn up early last year. And a lot of people, when Trump said this at the news conference with Benjamin Netanyahu, that they felt that it was just sort of off the cuff, fly, you know, seat of your pants kind of thing, and it would just evolved of the moment, and nobody really knew, you know, that it was coming. But further reporting has said that this is a proposal that has been in the works for 2, maybe even 3 years of looking at it, even going back prior to October 7th in some ways. And so I think that's an interesting element to this.
Yeah, I think the president has spoken with his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, about this. Apparently Kushner bought into this this idea sometime back. And that's, you know, that's fine. It's not a crime to have ideas. But when you're the president of the United States, when you're the commander-in-chief, If you're going to cause U.S. if you want U.S. policy in the Middle East to make a U-turn, if you want to essentially drop everything this country has stood for in the past, you owe it to yourself to speak with your key foreign policy and national security advisors first before speaking.
Sarah.
Yeah, I for one don't want to get used to this. You know, I remember I have a master's in diplomacy and international relations. Nothing close to your level of experience, Ambassador.
Sounds pretty good to me.
But one day in my life, I thought that I would want to do what you've done with your life, and you know, we would run simulations all the time, and students would do this, you know, to disrupt the regular patterns of diplomacy. There are rules. There are. There are documents that have been debated and articulated and constructed by global leaders for decades that govern these conversations. And of course, Trump doesn't want to be a part of that. But unlike other authoritarian regimes where the leader says jump and everyone has to go, we live in America. So we have a say in terms of like where we feel this direction is going, whether it's okay, whether it makes sense. It sounds like what you're saying, Ambassador, is that it's a very quick pivot to a national security situation. And I wonder if it's like a global security situation, where are the checks and balances on what he says? Because in diplomacy, it's all language. It's all about word choice, down to the phrasing, the spacing, meaningful pauses. It's so subtle, and he's like a bull in a china shop. So, where are the guardrails anymore when we're so far outside the norms of diplomatic relations? Is the default just national security and threats and armaments, or like where does this go? It sounds very scary.
Yeah, I mean, diplomacy can be very coercive at times. Diplomacy is a tool of national power, and using that tool effectively is what it's all about. If President Trump is interested in bringing about fundamental changes to the way the Gaza Strip is governed, organized, et cetera, fine. There is a lot of expertise in the U.S. government, in academia, elsewhere, about how to articulate that and how to implement it, how to bring it about. And what bothers me is that the president doesn't seem to be interested in the nature of the tools at his disposal, that just articulating his opinion seems to be enough for him.
So where do the conversations happen? And maybe this is a question for our national security advisor, but like our homeland security advisor. But where are those conversations happening then? The conversations that will actually dictate what happens in the world? Because what Donald Trump says is not what's going to happen in the world.
No.
Right now, I don't think we understand where those conversations are occurring. I mean, normally it would be within the bureaucracy that they're pretty much decapitating right now. You would also have a counterbalance in the committee system through both the Senate and the House, neither of whom have shown any impulse to control the urges. I mean, I find it really interesting is that someone like Tulsi Gabbard, who sort of took a really hard position against American foreign policy, saying it was too interventionist, absolutely dead silence on this idea of basically taking Gaza. I mean, I can't imagine a foreign policy that would be more interventionist than that. But there are a couple other issues that I want to toss on the table. One, both of your comments about diplomacy is really interesting, given the fact that one of the most powerful tools that the United States has had in its diplomatic quiver was USAID, and the fact that I watched briefly the press conference, and I was sort of reading the cartoon bubble over King Abdullah's head that was like, okay, boomer. But he's concerned. He's more concerned about the $1.5 billion in aid that Jordan gets than he is about what's happening in Gaza. I mean, so this idea of gutting USAID took this huge tool away from us. That idea of soft power, getting people to do what you want to do, you know, is a coercive. Yeah, it is, but it's a more gentle coercive than saying, well, I've got more aircraft carriers than you, which is going to just generate the type of arms race that historically I think gets us into huge issues. So you've got that issue, and I got to say these words, Joe. The idea of moving 2 million people from Gaza, so that you could force the creation of Mar-a-Lago 2. Let's call it what it is. It's ethnic cleansing. All right. I mean, neither Egypt nor Jordan nor anybody else wants to accept 2 million impoverished, war-torn Palestinians into their populations. I also find it so interesting that you've got a guy who's running on this campaign of anti-immigration and having to put up walls and you know, think about all of the garbage that we see coming out of Holman and the whole corrupt.
Send them elsewhere.
But then he's going to force relocate. The Gazans into areas that are unprepared for them, and the other part of it, and I'll turn it back to the other two panelists. Jordan is already struggling under a huge burden of dislocated populations that already borders on a humanitarian crisis, and this guy and his darling daughter and son-in-law are going to come in and try to put up another casino. Wow, that really is going to create great will across the world.
We go to this issue where there seems to be wanting some. We have a really bad situation. This is what the Gaza Strip looks like. Yeah. It is a hellhole. We're told
demolition site.
So we're just gonna.
Joe, you asked the question before the break. Does the president know,
right,
that this scheme is not going to happen? My tentative response to that would be no. He does not know. It's not going to happen. President Trump, there is no evidence that he has ever paid much attention to the politics of the various leaders of the Arab world, including Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, who has been his closest contact. He's just not paying attention to how politically unacceptable and subversive it would be to ethnically cleanse 2 million Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. You know, the best American leader I ever witnessed in this respect, in knowing cold the politics of other parties, was Secretary of State Jim Baker. There was simply no one better. He never said anything. He never went into a meeting without knowing cold the politics of his opposite number. This is perhaps the greatest key to successful diplomacy. You know, what we see in President Trump, at least what I see, I guess this may be very superficial, but I see no evidence of any curiosity at all about the capabilities of other parties to move in the direction he wants to move in. What I see is someone who is entirely self-centered and who actually believes that the Arab world, whether the leaders like it or not, will come around to his point of view. He seems to genuinely believe that. I don't believe that there is any particular strategy behind his proposal.
That was Fred Hoff on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, February 12th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, February 13th, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, former advance lead for the White House and former chief of staff for State Senator Michelle Hinchey, and former assistant county executive for Pat Ryan, Anna Markowitz, and former Times Union associate editor Mike Spain.
President Donald Trump spoke by phone on Wednesday to Russian President Vladimir Putin in their first publicized call since Trump returned to the White House, breaking a years-long silence between the Oval Office and the Kremlin as the U.S. leader kicked off a bid to end Russia's war in Ukraine. Trump had warm words for the Russian leader, who has ruled Russia for 25 years and has repeatedly invaded neighboring nations and killed, imprisoned, or exiled his most formidable opposition, as he declared that the two men would visit each other's countries and, quote, agreed to work together very closely. Trump, who also spoke with Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky later in the day, said that he and Putin would probably meet without Zelensky in Saudi Arabia in the not-too-distant future. I think President Putin wants peace. President Zelensky wants peace. And I want peace, he told reporters in the Oval Office. I just want to see people stop getting killed. We're very far away from that particular war, but that's a vicious war. The call, which the Kremlin said lasted nearly 90 minutes, illustrated the deepening alliance between Trump and Putin in the ways that are likely to unsettle Zelensky. In offering the first outline of his vision for a peace deal, Trump focused heavily on the terms that Russia cares most about, and he appeared to rule out NATO membership for Ukraine while placing the bulk of the burden for defending it on Europe. Trump's declarations offered major concessions to Putin even before the negotiations had formally begun. Putin has long sought to block Ukraine from NATO, and even if Trump had no intention of allowing Kyiv into the alliance, he would have preserved the possibility as a bargaining chip. Putin also has wanted to negotiate about Ukraine's future directly with the U.S. leader over Kyiv's head, a coup Trump also appeared to hand him on Wednesday. All right. So that from the Washington Post. And who would like to begin?
I can go first.
Excellent.
So I find this pretty concerning. I was doing a little bit of reading on how Europe responded to this, because I couldn't imagine that they would take that well to be excluded from the initial peace discussions. And it, lo and behold, is true. They had a NATO meeting in Brussels, and the defense ministers for NATO are alarmed that they won't be included in such an important discussion with the peace talks. And I mean, I think that it is alarming that someone who has been so friendly with Putin is going to be the primary negotiator for peace. And I think that the Ukraine is obviously trying to be diplomatic to Trump to not alienate themselves and get a worse deal out of the situation. But I think it's very alarming that Europe and Ukraine wouldn't be included in this.
Mike?
Yeah, this pretty sudden reversal of the past policies we've had is supporting Ukraine in their effort to combat the invasion by Russia. It's stunning in many ways. Are we really surprised? I don't think so. But to see it is pretty stunning. You know, giving as the story you read noted, Trump has already given Putin a couple of things that he demanded. And what next? Next thing he's going to want is large territories of eastern Ukraine, and it's going to be very difficult for anybody to walk that back. I mean, already it looks like he's caving in to Putin. He likes to think of himself as a really powerful, strong leader. Putin plays to that very well. He was flattering him and complimenting him, and it's just kind of it's difficult to watch. And you know, Europe has to be at that table. Ukraine, of course, has to be at that table, and it looks like they're being blocked out. I mean, this is about the security of Europe. It's about the very thing that formed NATO after World War II. It's to prevent this kind of brutal takeover of countries by others, and we're letting it happen, it looks like, after all of the effort we put in to help Ukraine support itself.
Teresa.
Yeah, I think when Mark Vogel arrived at the White House and President Trump was talking, he really signaled this then in the level of praise he had for Putin and when he was talking about Ukraine, and you could really see this coming. And so it's clear there will be a table. The Ukraine belongs at the table, as the European leaders have said they belong at the table. But the only thing, as you listen to Trump, you have to wonder what side of the table is he on, because it really sounds like that he and Putin are on the same side of the table. And that really is a cataclysmic change, a cataclysmic realigning. And not only when there he was when Tulsi Gabbard was being sworn in, and take that in for a moment about the irony of her being sworn in as a national security advisor on the same day that this is all happening, remembering her connections or the questions people had about her and Putin. But when he was asked at the media availability, are you going to have Zelensky participate in the talks? He said, well, not at that first meeting. They are reportedly going to meet in Saudi Arabia. He said, not at this first meeting. And, you know, there are elections coming, too. I found that stunning. And then he said, he was asked, do you see Zelensky as an equal partner in the negotiations? And he said, interesting question. I don't think so. That was a not very smart war to get into. And he said, and his poll numbers are not that great. So what side of the table is he on? And what does this do now? Already there was a realignment going on in the world in ways that I think were hard to figure out, where China sits, where Russia sits with China. But for so long, we've had a very firm alliance with NATO. But what does this do to that? What's the global impact? And then I was reflecting, and I went back and looked, and I don't really know what this means, but certainly he's very close to Musk. And if you go back in October, there were a whole series of articles about Musk's conversations with Putin, that the New York Times and others had written about. And you wonder, you know, is that relevant anyway? You know, where are we going? And the other thing I just say is that he constantly says we have to stop that war. Wars are no good. He describes the killing and how terrible it is, and it has to be stopped. His language is different when he talks about Gaza and the bombing in Gaza, right? And also, if you think about the sort of tearing apart of the USAID programs, and what all experts, Republicans, Democrats, I think particularly of the person who at the Bush administration was in charge of USAID, and he was talking about how important that is, that soft power is, in terms of keeping the peace around the world. So there are a lot of pieces of this puzzle that don't really fit, but we certainly are in new territory, and not sure who's aligned with who. Interesting, too, that Modi from India is here today, and you wonder how that conversation goes as well in terms of the world order. I'd be interested in hearing. I was thinking, and I'm talking too much, but I was thinking about Ukraine and when this war started and the outpouring of support all around the country for Ukraine and you know, the people who had vigils and such. And I'd be interested in hearing with some of those folks today, particularly who people who have family in Ukraine and how they're feeling about this.
We have about 2 minutes before we go to a break, but Mike, you touched on this, and I read it for a moment in the story from the Washington Post. But this idea of you have a bargaining chip, maybe one or two or three, and you just hand them over. You
right.
You walk in and you put them on the table and say, "Oh, here, I brought you something."
The defense secretary, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Hegseth was in Europe yesterday as Teresa mentioned, with the military leaders from NATO, and he kind of precluded what Trump said. He said Europe should take care of Ukraine. It's up their issue, and said NATO should never accept Ukraine as a member, and he said it was unrealistic to see Ukraine hold on and get back territory it lost to Russia during this awful war. So I mean, they're all speaking in unison, and you can understand why our long-standing close allies for decades and decades are looking at us right now and wondering what happened.
All right. So let's go to a couple of the letters, and then we'll continue on in this discussion, because there is more to discuss. But John says, come on, gang. Can we find some sunshine and some sunflowers and the ending of the senseless war? A million young people are dead. Weapons makers got fat and nothing was gained. The expansion of NATO is a threat to Russia. Stop letting Russophobia cloud your thinking. The end of this war is a good thing.
Certainly, John, the end of the war is a good thing. And the stopping of the killing is a good thing. And how could anyone not want that? But after the millions of people who have died, young people have died, and the devastation that it's caused, should it be all for nothing? I mean, these people were defending their country, defending their ability to, be independent. And NATO and the United States came to their support to help them do it. And now we just throw that all under the bus and allow, I don't know if it's Russian phobia or Moscow phobia, whatever. I think it's a legitimate threat. Putin wants to expand his borders, wants to extend the influence of Russia back to the days of the Soviet Union. And he's made it very clear that's what he's trying to do. And after Ukraine, what's he going to do? Go to the Balkans and go to Estonia and the countries that left the old Soviet Union and became independent and leaned toward the West? Is he going to go after them? Maybe Poland will be next.
Norway.
Yeah, right. Norway, too. I mean, what's going to stop him if we just hand him exactly what he wants? And it sounds like that's what we're doing.
And if you're ending one war, that is right. We should say that is a good thing. But if we're setting up the chess pieces for more conflict across the globe, obviously not a good thing.
Right. I think that's the thing to be very mindful of, is this realignment that he has accelerated in a very different direction. And remember how he weakened NATO pretty substantially, and President Biden and his team were able to re-knit together that alliance, and it's an essential alliance for us, and really strengthened our hand in a way to try to keep the peace. And so, yes, it is important to end the war. My sense was that Putin had no interest in doing that until Trump was back in power here in the United States, right? You don't think he was not going to negotiate with Biden to end the war because he saw Putin coming. I mean, Putin saw Trump coming back in. And
well, can I just say that certainly he was waiting for the outcome of the election mm-hmm. before he decided to do anything. But this war has been devastating to Russia. You know, it has wrecked their economy. It has killed so many young Russians. And he's, you know, he wants it to end for all those good reasons. You want war to end. But he's also continuing to wage the war, you know, while this goes on, and hold on to everything that they've taken illegally by marching into a sovereign nation. And you know, once you start to allow that to happen, that's what happened in Europe in the 1930s.
Exactly.
Right?
That's why we've seen this movie before. And Trump, you know, fancies himself the grand negotiator. But what grand negotiator starts by giving up everything before the talks start? And as well as then weakening, you know, if your side is Ukraine, why would you talk about how weak the leader is and note that their election's coming up? And what does that signal? You know, what's the positioning here and why? I mean, that's the deep question. And what are the Senate and the House Republicans going to say? What's Senator Lindsey Graham going to say? What are others, right?
My guess is nothing, right?
Nothing. But they who felt that we should, and why, you know, why are we withholding? I believe they're still withholding humanitarian aid. The humanitarian aid to Ukraine comes through USAID, and I believe that's still paused. I'm not 100% sure about that, but it was as of the other day. So, I mean, it just raises some very serious concerns about what our alignments are.
Anna?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Putin was obviously placing a bet that if he waited for Trump to get in power, that he would have much better negotiation stance with Ukraine and would likely get what he wanted because, as the other panelists mentioned, you know, he's lost a lot in this war. And if it's all for naught, if they don't get these territories, if Ukraine can join NATO, then what was it all for? So he was depending on Trump to look like he was strategic and won this thing. And so that's what is playing out now. And I think that Trump has always aligned with Putin. And this is coming at the same time as he's proposing that the U.S. take over Gaza. So, you know, there are concerns about him wanting to take over Greenland. And so I think that he's saying, okay, well, let me play well in the sandbox with Putin and let's see how this can impact America and maybe help us nation build, which is terrifying.
And, you know, as one of the – sorry.
Go ahead. Teresa.
One of the national security analysts I heard was saying, so what happens if China says, okay, we're going to take over – you know, we're going to come in and take over Taiwan. We're going to – and what – you know, sort of what's next? What's our – what is our role in the world now? And our the alliances we had, you know, back in – you know, the way, way back machine in January, those who are our friends, how do they know where the U.S. stands on anything anymore? And, you know,
I think that's pretty clear. Whatever the U.S. relationship with your country is, it's only at most 4 years long. You know, you just cannot predict what's going to happen at the end of a presidential term. So, you know, you have to start factoring that in and not considering the U.S. The major ally it's always been. Agree with them when you agree, but stand back when you stand back. I think that's what was going on in Europe. They knew the chance of Trump coming back.
Right. And which is why they were concerned.
That was Teresa Bourgeois on the roundtable panel on Thursday, February 13th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. On Friday, February 14th, Joe was joined by semi-retired editor-at-large, columnist, editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, and Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick.
Let us start with the Manhattan federal prosecutor, Danielle Sassoon.
Ooh la la.
Yes, indeed. Manhattan's federal prosecutor, Danielle Sassoon, the interim U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, quit yesterday. And she said the reason was because of the Justice Department ordering charges against the mayor of New York City, the Big Apple, Eric Adams, to be dropped. And she, along with five officials with the federal, get the name of this unit, the Public Integrity Unit, quit after the Justice Department ordered those charges to be dropped. When Justice Department officials transferred the case to the Public Integrity Section in Washington, which oversees corruption prosecutions, the two men who led that unit also resigned, according to five people with knowledge of the matter. Several hours later, three other lawyers in the unit also resigned, according to people familiar with the developments. The serial resignations represent the most high-profile public opposition so far to President Trump's tightening control over the Justice Department. They were a stunning repudiation of the administration's attempt to force the dismissal of the charges against Mayor Adams. The departures of the U.S. attorney, Danielle Sassoon, and the officials who oversaw the Justice Department's Public Integrity Section, Kevin O'Driscoll and John Keller, came in rapid succession on Thursday. Days earlier, the acting number two official of the Justice Department, Emil Bove, had ordered Manhattan prosecutors to drop the case against Mr. Adams. The agency's justification for dropping the case was explicitly political. Mr. Bove had argued that the investigation would prevent Mr. Adams from fully cooperating with Mr. Trump's immigration crackdown. Mr. Bove made a point of saying that Washington officials had not evaluated the strength of the evidence or the legal theory of the case. So in other words, they had to keep him on because they needed some help in the garage. Right? Like
I think it's a parallel to the argument or the practice of not prosecuting a sitting president, that it disrupts their ability to carry out their duties. This is just honestly the most out there. I'm using the word transparent in the like we're seeing stuff we don't usually see swap meet. But the underlying argument is, you know, here you have the chief executive of the largest city in the United States, arguably a pretty important economic engine, arguably has been very much struggling with the influx of undocumented individuals, whether they were sent here by other states or whatever. And there's this big friction between the city and the federal government over money and housing and all of that. That's really the whole context of it. Now, the the question about the prosecutors quitting their jobs, I mean, yeah, if they don't agree with it and they feel like they can't carry out the command, I guess that's the high profile thing to do. Put it in the paper and quit your job. But to me, the idea of them saying out loud, well, we think this is going to disrupt his ability to help with, the immigration thing. I don't find that shocking because I kind of expected they would ask him to anyways. So that to me is not a stunner.
I think when you read her resignation letter and you see the three key words, quid pro quo, in there, you realize how serious this is. Serious. Is it going to be enduring? Are there going to be more people in the Trump administration and particularly in the Justice Department, and later I think we'll see them in the FBI, who were handpicked by outfits like the Heritage Foundation, which apparently has a list of 54,000 people waiting to take jobs in this administration, presumably all MAGA loyalists just waiting to fulfill Trump's mandates. This is something that really went awry as far as the president's agenda is concerned. And I that's why I quoted the immortal philosopher James Brown.
But I would love to talk through the quid pro quo aspect of it, because that's interesting to me. But I think, I mean, obviously, Judy is going to have something to say here.
Well, I think Trump said to Adams, we're going to make the Justice Department make this case go away, and in return, you are going to make it easy for me to go and get immigrants out of your city. I think that's as simple as that.
And whatever else, right? Yeah. I mean, have New York City sort of friendly territory again, which it was not for a very long time.
You're not only going to do it, but I'm not going to completely take these charges away from you. I'm going to have them hanging over your head for the rest of your political career if you don't do what I say.
So do I think that's right? No, I don't think it's right. I think decisions should be made on the merits of the case. It could very well be important for New York City to cooperate with the federal government or not. But I think the case itself should have stood on its own. I think they're trying to hollow out the federal government so they can fill it back in with people who are loyal to Donald Trump. Is it equivalent to the Saturday Night Massacre during the Nixon administration? I don't know. It certainly isn't being played as aggressively in the media as a Saturday Night Massacre back in the 70s.
Well, it's more like a...
Maybe explain the context of the Saturday Night Massacre.
So when during the Nixon administration, there was this effort by the Attorney General to make the Watergate tapes available, and when they refused to comply with Nixon's order, rather than do that, they got fired. I think I don't think they resigned voluntarily, and one after another, I think I had two or three attorney generals just step away because they were not going to enact or follow an unlawful order. I mean, it's people standing up to power. We had a little bit of the same thing early on in the Trump administration, where people would resign rather than do things they thought were unlawful. And you know what? In any administration, that happens, where people say, I just can't do this. But the idea that we can't prosecute anybody sitting in office, a mayor, a town councilman, just because they're in office or happen to be running for office or reelection. They're always running for reelection. And so that would be, as long as you're elected, no corruption can be filed against you. That's just wrong.
It's amazing to me, and I this may come off more negative than I mean it to sound, but I don't think it'll come off any other way, which is, It seems like many are looking at these five people, and especially Sassoon, as, oh my God, there's someone who has a spine. Yeah. Oh goodness gracious, where did that come from? Because we haven't had that for 10 years.
Well, we did. We had a few exceptions.
No, we
out
did.
There. We
You're
had
right.
Sally Yates. Yeah. We had Vindman. We had people in the Justice Department that threatened to resign over the January 6th.
A lot of people, resigned after January 6th, but it was on their last day.
Yeah, but we haven't seen it, I don't think, in this new Trump 2.0 administration, and we haven't seen it on this scale. This isn't just a few random people out there in the wilderness. This is a U.S. attorney, an acting U.S. attorney, and multiple people from the Public Integrity Unit. I was surprised that they did not vet these people more carefully.
Well, they were, and she was internal.
Yeah.
She was internal, and she has a very high-profile history. Like, she, I think, did the Sam Bankman-Fried case.
Yeah.
At least she worked on it.
She clerked for Scalia?
Yeah. I mean, she's definitely somebody that—
Conservative, we should note.
Maybe. Who cares? I have this issue with,
okay.
with, you know, somehow someone is lesser because they're liberal or because they're conservative. I think they're different viewpoints, and there can be valid viewpoints on both sides.
Oh, but, absolutely. But she's not out there liberal. You
know, no, but I will say, and I agree with Judy, that you should not be totally free from prosecution when you sit in office. However, in recent years, in my view, and when I say recent, I mean, let's go back like 15 or so, particularly in New York, prosecutions have been used as a tool to bring down political figures on some of the most specious of evidence. I mean, I think of there was a senator in the Southern Tier who was forced to resign from office and threatened with jail time because when the FBI asked him, did he help his son get a job, he said no.
Hmm.
Not under oath, not required to be under oath, but apparently it is a felony to lie to the FBI. I challenge you to find another case before that where someone was prosecuted for something that was a casual conversation. It was very much politically motivated. There's a history of this. And what they've done with the Eric Adams case is to me, a parallel of the mistakes that were made with the Trump case. They dragged it out to try and gain some political value out of it because this is an election year. And so, you know, it's the slow unwrapping of the presents, and then this one, and oh, they raided this one's house, and oh, and you know, let's build this all up to the grand indictment. And it's all timed and it's all very specific. I worked in a prosecutor's office. You know, if you're doing a long-term investigation, you usually don't announce each step of the way. The only reason you do it is because you want to get some kind of reaction from the people who are being investigated. And I think that they misplayed it. Now, I'm not saying she was wrong to resign. She may be right to resign. And I'm not saying that it is right to dismiss the charges. But I'm saying the context is very muddy here. It has clearly been handled in a political way. So, you know, if the flip side of it is you have to capitulate and help me out on this immigration stuff, he's been asking for help before this. He's been asking for help from the federal government. During the Biden administration, he was asking for help. So I'm not sure that he was forced into a position that he didn't want to take. I mean, maybe it's more than he wants to do, but, you know, he's also a former law enforcement official. So he may see things more from the same viewpoint as the Trump administration. I don't know. I don't mean to speak for him, but I think there's a lot more context than what some of the reporting has been, or there's different ways to look at it.
One correction on that.
Okay.
The leaks, she points out in her own memo, the leaks did not come from the prosecution. The leaks came from the defense. So any manipulation of the press that was going on here, any manipulation of public opinion, I don't want to say any, some of the manipulation.
Yeah.
Because obviously, if you're arresting people along the way, that's as good as a leak.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, you're kind of making an announcement there. But the leaks that were coming out that were, you know, intended to be damaging were coming from the defense.
I mean, some of the information that was out there about folks who worked around them was the pressure that was being placed upon them was immense, immense. And, I mean, the power of a prosecution to destroy a person's life can't be understated. I mean, it really can't. You can't unring that bell. Once you've been indicted, it's the whole, where do you go to get your reputation back?
All right. So we're talking about what happened in Manhattan. And it is a fascinating story in many respects. I one has to wonder of how... Now,
brown cow, get out of my head.
Now, give the farm metaphors. I assume Trump will exact some sort of revenge.
always going to be nasty, nasty truths,
yes,
as they call them.
Yes.
And it isn't over. I mean, you know, first they have to find a lackey willing to do this. And then they have to convince a judge. As she pointed out, she didn't even think this would necessarily fly in a court to go in and say, here's the reasons we're doing it. And the judge may well have said, no, I don't accept that. And we've seen that. We saw it in the Hussein case, or up here with the limo crash, where a deal had been worked out and they went in, and it was community service and no jail time. And the judge, Peter Lynch, said, no. I'm not going to accept this. This is a miscarriage of justice. Now, in that case, the confession had already been made and the judge knew it. In this case, you know, it's the weight of the evidence, which she feels is very strong. So, you know, it may not even get that far. But, yeah, I think this is going to cause some people in the administration to have a lot of rethinking about who they've hired, you know, whether there's going to be a new round of loyalty checks and so forth. I don't know, but they don't like it. I'm sure he doesn't like this embarrassment. This is an embarrassment.
Yeah, and she was elevated from within.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean that's, and I know we said that already, but so she wasn't someone who came and was plopped in there as a Trump appointee. You know, I think that person is still waiting to be. I don't know if they need to be approved. So you know, she was acting. So who knows if she was going to stay anyways. I don't know.
Right. There may be some attacks on her pension or, I mean, that they go that route or they go, you know, the trite, mean kind of route. But because I think they need to make a point that this is not going to be tolerated, this kind of standing up and rejecting an order from above. But it may be a blip. I'm sure we're going to be talking about something different tomorrow, Sunday, Monday. It just never stops. The stuff keeps coming down the
spaghetti fast.
Yeah.
It's like everything is thrown at the wall all at once, and you have to pick which strand you want to talk about.
The then of course, you know, it brings in the whole Eric Adams and reelection and his race and what he's doing now and. It's all quite fascinating because he's operating as if nothing happened.
And as if he's actually got a chance at this point. Maybe he does. I mean, look, we could have a race with Eric Adams and Andrew Cuomo.
I don't see that.
I mean, just this amazing redemption ticket.
Eric Adams as a Republican?
I don't see that happening. I mean, I think he's probably got an exit strategy, but if you're in charge of a city like New York, or if you're in charge of a state or any large governmental entity, you can't announce that you're not going to run again. You know, I mean, in order to govern, you have to act like you're all hands on deck going to run again if you want to have any kind of ability to wield influence. Mm-hmm. And New York is a tough city to govern to begin with, right? So but I don't. I just don't. I can't imagine he's going to run again. I think once that becomes clear, and it may not become clear to us, it may become clear to others. Like when petitions are filed, we'll know if he's running again. If Andrew Cuomo files petitions, I think we'll know Eric Adams is not running. you know, so I don't see them both running as Democrats. I just don't. I mean, maybe Adams goes to the Republican side, but I just don't believe that would happen either.
That was Heather Mulligan on the Roundtable panel on Friday, February 14th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.